Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and I just want to thank you for joining the Dr. Drew podcast and supporting the Corolla Pirate Ship here at the Corolla Network. And please, just a reminder, tell a friend about these podcasts. That is how this thing grows organically, and that is how we want this to grow. We want it to be a community of people that connect, and we talk about interesting things. And by the way, feel free to give us feedback and stuff, particularly for my show, that you'd like to hear. We'll be happy to set it up on the program. And again, tell a friend and keep this pirate ship afloat.
This is Corolla Digital.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the program. It is the Dr. Drew podcast. I'm going to get right off to some calls here. Now, this is Sunny. What's going on, Sunny?
Hi, Dr. Drew.
Hi, Sunny. What's going on there?
Oh, I'm so happy I got to get through to you finally. I'm calling from Colorado. I watch your show, and I watch how you do celebrity rehab. And I was also an addict myself, recovering, celebrated 5 years.
Hey, congratulations. That's a big deal. It's a huge deal.
However, I lost my kids to the state, and I've been trying to fight to get them back. And I'm having some hard times being represented legally because it's been so many years. And I just want to know, what would be your advice on some steps and some ways that I could work on trying to get them home? Or
I mean, I don't know the system in Colorado. Obviously, I practice in California. But I would think that if you had testimonials both from, say, your sponsor or people in the recovering community, your employer, are you employed right now?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, your employer and then your doctors. If you could get a physician to say, hey, this woman is now stable and there's no reason that you shouldn't. Somebody, a professional that would go put their reputation on the line to say that Sunny is A, capable of doing this, and B, you're not putting kids in harm's way. Those three things, I would think would be pretty – in California, they want to get kids back to the parents. I don't know about Colorado, but I would think that would make it relatively easy. And then go to what's called Legal Aid Society. Have you been to Legal Aid Society?
Yes, sir.
Did they advise
you? They denied me because of so many years. She said that they couldn't find anyone to represent me.
That's crazy.
It's frustrating because it's been almost 10 years since I've seen them.
Oh, my God.
My children. I have a 2-year-old that I'm raising now.
Yeah. Well, Sunny, I'm so sorry. Are they adults now?
My oldest is 16.
The oldest is
16.
Yeah. Do you visit them?
I don't. I haven't seen them in 10 years. He was 8 when he left, and he's 16 now.
I must tell you something. I'm bewildered why the state won't help you. I'm bewildered. I really am. I think that, again, the priority in most systems is to reunite, particularly mom, with their kids. And a mom that has five years of sobriety under her belt deserves to be reunited, even if it's – forget custody, just reunited.
Right. Visitations, or even if I could do therapy with them, because, you know, I know there's a process. Nobody's just going to hand them back and say, oh, okay, well, here she is.
Yeah.
After all these years, I know it's a process, but to even have therapy with them so we can grow together would be great.
Sunny,
I know we're all going to need that. Getting them all home.
Sunny,
and,
you sound like
and
a,
with them getting changed back you, over to me, we would all need therapy together,
Sunny,
and things of those natures.
You sound like a dream. You sound like a dream for what child services would want from the parent that lost the kids. So I would say my basic advice is beat the door down at Child Protective Services, at Social Services. You know, get these testimonials on paper and go in there and go, look, I'm who I say I am. Here's people that will stand by that. And just go with that, my dear. Come on now. Let's do that. Let's get in there. Forget the attorneys. Go straight to Social Services yourself. Thanks, Sunny. I got to move on here. And I also just want to remind everybody about our friends at Lumosity.com. I am telling you right now, go there, click on the Start Training button, and you begin training your brain for free. I go to Lumosity all the time, and I do some of the exercises there. They also will give you daily reminders and daily exercises, and you can actually track your progress with this thing. It's a way of working your brain out just the way you'd work your body out. We all spend a lot of time working on our bodies. How about we work on the brain a little bit, particularly the memory function? Those of you that may not have paid attention so much during high school, here's your chance to do a little catch up. At Lumosity, they believe they're giving you sharper, more focused, better problem solving, improved memory, all stuff that's going to help you in your function in daily life and at work. So I use it every day. I particularly like that. I think I've said this before. I like the one where you there. It's a memory game where you sort of click on boxes and the patterns show up and you have to remember the patterns. It's not easy. I don't dig the fact that I have trouble remembering this stuff. And so it's challenging to get yourself better and you can watch your progress on graphs. Again, reminder, go to Lumosity.com. Corolla goes there. I go there. Start training button and tell them you heard it from me, Dr. Drew. Now, enjoy the program. Welcome to Dr. Drew Podcast. I'm delighted to welcome my guest today, Dr. Stephen Johnson. His book is The Sacred Path, The Way of the Spiritual Warrior. It is available. Click through on the Amazon barrier, drdrew.com, Amazon bar, that is. And we also have it on our book section where you can just click on it and get it right away. Dr. Johnson is a psychotherapist, an educator, 40 years full-time practice in the Southern California area. He is the co-founder and director of the Los Angeles Men's Leadership Guild, as well as the North American Confederation of Men's Council. His website is Dr. Stephen with a P-H, S-T-E-P-H-E-N, Johnson, J-O-H-N-S-O-N, drstephenjohnson.com is the website. And just from that intro, I hope everyone gets the sense that this man is involved with men.
That's right.
All about man. And he commented, we had very limited time to meet, you and I, just a few seconds shake hands before we ran in here because we're running a little bit late today. And you were admiring the Corolla man cave.
Indeed. Total envy.
Yeah. And, you know, he is someone that has been for a long time. Are you familiar with Adam? And
I am.
Yeah.
Sure.
And he has been talking for a long time about men and in his own little way, what it feels like to be a man who values those parts of him that are masculine and having difficulty expressing them without feeling, I don't know, less than or somehow diminished. You know, he had a mom that was not very supportive of that kind of thing. And and now he sort of pounds everyone over the head with it. Now he's, you know, including his wife.
Right.
But tell us, you know, what do you, just to start with a broad stroke, what do you see as the sort of the overriding issue for men today?
I think the biggest issue for men is actually the crisis in fathering, which I call the father gap.
Well, again, I'm going to use Mr. Corolla because this is his pirate ship we're all on here today.
Yeah.
And he always says, you know, the president stood up and said, you know, it takes courage to raise a child.
Mm-hmm.
Courage? To your basic sacred duty that everyone should automatically understand is their absolute categorical responsibility? That takes courage? What does it take courage? It takes courage to do your duty?
Well, I think it takes a lot of responsibility to be a good parent.
Oh, Gary's adjusting where you got to go right – like your mouth is right against that thing. There you
like
go.
That, okay.
Yeah, of course. It's hard work. I have triplets. It's hard work.
You know, I was talking with a couple yesterday, you know, and their parents, and they were just, you know, talking about how difficult it is.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, the people that don't have children, that didn't want to have children, research indicates are the happiest. It's very difficult to be a parent these days.
The other thing is when they study happiness in a marriage, the nadir, the bottom, is during the child years, during the childhood, you know, during like the – preschool and grade school years.
That's right.
Yeah.
Parenting is forever and it just gets, you know, difficult.
But men are checking out of it.
A lot of men are checking out of it and a lot of people are choosing not to marry. You know, they've seen a lot of divorce and they've decided that they don't want to be any part of that. So, that, you know,
they blame marriage for failed relationships. Really, that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
They blame a legal status that's there to protect them and their children as the cause of a dysfunctional relationship.
That's right, that they're locked in, and they also know that people are living longer, and therefore marriage means that you can be in it for a long time.
Yeah.
And so they want a lot more autonomy, independence, and flexibility.
So what's the solution? What do you say?
Well, in terms of marriage, of a happy marriage.
Well, let's just stay with your opening volley, which was the crisis in fathering.
Well, what we know is that we have about upwards of 20 million kids that go to bed each night without a father in the next room. And when boys especially don't have fathers, then they tend to get into trouble. A lot of the work that I do through the Men's Center of Los Angeles is working with fellas that get in trouble, helping them to try to avoid trouble but also to find their way out of trouble.
So it's males who've not had good relationships with a male figure,
That's
dad.
Right.
Who get into trouble and you guys try to serve that function?
Exactly. What we do is we, you know, the vision that I had was to bring good men together and bring out the best in them, put good men in the lives of fellas, especially fellas that didn't have good fathering. So we have a mentor program, and we bring men who want to be there as father figures in the lives of young fellas or even older fellas.
How is that different than the old Big Brother, Big Sister, or whatever that was?
It's not really that different. The Big Brother program is actually excellent. We're just, you know, kind of approaching it, you know, from our own design.
And to sort of pile on what you're saying, there's been research in psychological literature for a long time about the protective factor of a good, stable relationship, even a friendship, frankly,
right,
with a peer, but especially a good, stable relationship with an adult.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, fellas need something to come up against. They need structure, especially going through adolescence. It's very difficult.
I'm going to play devil's advocate for a second and throw in a polemic here, which is, well, mom can. Why are we taking aim at single moms? Mom can offer structure.
We're not taking aim. In fact, Obama, you know, said when he spoke the other day, he said, "I wish I had a father around." But he said, "My mom raised me," and he said, "And I got to hand it to the single moms out there that are trying to do a good job. It's just very difficult for a woman when a boy, you know, is, you know, adolescent, when, you know, he's going through puberty. The testosterone, you know, starts to really surge through his body. That's when he needs men around.
Yeah, he gets aggressive.
Containment.
Yeah, and women can handle that, I guess.
No, they can.
I don't know if they can.
Well, we know gangs feed on fatherless boys.
Mm. In the Sacred Path, the Way of the Spiritual Warrior, what are people going to learn?
Well, what they're going to learn is the first part of the book is really about why and how men get into trouble. The second part of the book, which is called A Return to Chivalry, has to do with what I say are, you know, the key characteristics of how a man can grow up to become mindful.
Mm.
It has to do with self-discipline, positive intentionality, experiencing valor, honor.
Well, let's
compassion.
Not break in because those are that's a lot of packed. That's a big, pretty big packed
yeah,
field
yeah.
You laid out.
Right.
What are your? Give me some highlights. Valor fascinates me. How do you enhance valor?
Well, valor is like courage, but you know it's the mission of what am I going to actually be courageous about? You know, I want men to understand what their destiny is in life. Why are they here? What is the gift that they have that they can actually actualize in their life?
What do they tend to come to?
That's right. And it takes courage or valor, you know, to rise to that occasion.
Valor sounds better. It sounds more medieval.
Yeah.
What do they generally get to? Is it service, that sort of thing?
Or, yes. Yeah. The third part, the last section of that book is about spiritual warriors in the world. It's the work that we as good men in the world, you know, are called on to do. It's our mission in life. It's whether it's to, you know, be a good father, to a good husband, a responsible family member, to go on and find a career, a vocation that has some real meaning, to be of service, to make something, a form of accomplishment that we can, you know, give back to the world.
How do you get, I mean, that sounds lovely,
mm-hmm.
but how do you get that through to a kid that has been traumatized, who comes from a culture where money and aggression and other values are more highly esteemed? How do you get them to buy into it?
Well, you know, we actually have a program called The Call to Adventure, where we bring African-American boys in with their mentors from the inner city. We bring them to retreats, four-day retreats. They have an opportunity to go through a ropes course, American Indian sweat lodges. There we have large group and small group time, breakout sessions where they can...
So hold on. So that's kind of interesting. So you go back to primitive rituals.
That's right.
So these kids are...
That's right.
And let's be fair.
Rites of passage.
And I'm not taking aim at this population. I'm talking about the kids that are at risk.
Yeah.
Are primitive. They tend to be kind of primitive.
Mm-hmm.
So using primitive rituals gets them engaged.
Exactly.
That's interesting.
Yes.
I never thought about that. What happens in the sweat lodges? What have you seen? What's the magic?
Well, you know, they get to face them. You know, it's about courage. So they're going into something that's very hot, it's very closed, it's very scary. And in a way, it's scary. That's very different than the kind of scariness that they face on a day-to-day basis. You know, living in the inner city, they see a lot of there's a lot of crime. There's a lot of death. You know, and they have to sort of, you know, man up every day to try to deal with that. We bring them up and put them through different kinds of things like the ropes course, high elements, they're off the ground, they're doing things, you know, that are very, very challenging.
Well, manning up, I imagine, in their world means disconnecting from feelings and showing aggression.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get them to twist that into, you know, accessing feelings and expressing
right.
them? And isn't that hard?
They get to be boys again. When they feel safe to be vulnerable, then they drop down and they get to actually be boys. And when they come up to this retreat that's north of Malibu, a lot of them haven't even seen the ocean.
You know, they're looking. These kids from Los Angeles?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
They haven't even seen the ocean. They've seen it on television. Or they pass under, you know, the LAX and they're looking at the planes because what do they see mostly? They see helicopters flying above.
Where do you get these kids? How do they come to you?
We work in partnership with mentor programs. We have one program that Clyde Terry, who's the sheriff, runs, is called Emerging Leaders. He's working actually with fellows that are coming out of prison. These guys are reformed felons. They started to turn their lives around when they were in prison, and then he helps them and teaches them a lot of what it really means to be a man.
So while I'm fascinated by all that, and those are major issues, and hats off to you for tackling all that, those aren't the guys downloading these podcasts.
Oh,
so
mm-hmm.
right?
Gotcha.
I mean,
right.
I imagine.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the average guy that's going to be, you know, downloading, listening to something like this? What's he dealing with? What's his issue as a man? Because I thought you were going to get into how we have pathologized maleness and male behaviors, and how we have. I just think about more recently mm-hmm. the basic. Characters or caricatures that you see in media, which is the incompetent male that with the competent woman that can, you know, is going to straighten him out, and he's almost like the buffoon is what males become.
Yeah, you know, we started to have a movement within men, a men's movement 30 years ago, and then the media got a hold of it and started actually to create parodies of men going off and bonding and hugging and, you know, sitting around the fire. And so men actually retreated and they moved away from it.
Mm. So you blame the media for that?
Well, the media had a lot to do with it,
listen,
very frankly.
I'm always ready to jump on.
I know. The media had a lot to do with it because, you know, men are very sensitive to shame. And when they feel a sense of shame,
embarrassment, yeah.
Yeah, you know, then they tend to either, you know, retreat or to become aggressive and act out. You know,
right.
You know, anger plus shame is, you know, equals rage, right?
So, right. Or we either go in the cave or come out and attack.
Yeah. Probably a lot of the listeners of the podcast would be interested in the third chapter of my book, which has to do with why men fall for dangerous relationships.
Why is that?
Well, you know, it goes back to the dawn of time, Adam and Eve, and, you know, how men and women get in trouble with each other. And so a lot of the fellas, you know, wind up in trouble, you know, at some point, you know, with usually, you know, in tow, a woman in tow or, you know, pulling him into a situation where, you know, he loses control and winds up in trouble in one way or another.
I mean, that sounds vague. Tell me more specifically what you mean.
Well,
I'm thinking of Jody Arias.
Exactly.
Right now.
That's a very specific example because, you know, Jody Arias, obviously a dangerous woman, you know. I talk about men getting involved with borderline personality disorder women.
Okay. Now there's some infertile territory because borderlines tend to be very sexual, very manipulative, very easy to get into their web.
They're very smart, very charismatic, very attractive, very charming, mm-hmm. you know, and narcissistic men are really the most vulnerable for
Absolutely.
Women like that because what these gals do is they mirror the fella, and so the guy always feels, oh, I've just met the woman of my dreams.
And she loves me. She's
she
into
loves
me.
Me.
She thinks I'm so great.
Well, because she adores him.
And it's interesting, the borderline female is prone to victimization by the sociopathic male.
Right.
And then the narcissistic male is prone to exploitation by the borderline female.
Well, they're
interesting.
They're personality disorders.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
But they're
traits we all have, and so those are common connectedness.
On the continuum, it goes from benign to malignant.
Yeah,
in this
particular
case with Jody Arias, it was malignant, you know, obviously.
But it's a great case example of how bad this can get. I mean,
most men, it's rare to find a fella, you know, that hasn't been involved with a borderline woman. He will always say, you know, it was the best sex I ever had.
Yeah.
You know, it was incredible, but it just was horrible.
Right,
wound,
the chaos,
you know, the woman of my dreams became my worst nightmare.
Yeah. They have trouble even describing how. I was in a spin cycle. You can't imagine it.
Right,
it's craziness.
Yeah.
Well, what happened? It was just terrible.
I don't know. It started out so great, and then all of a sudden,
I don't know what
happened.
Bluey.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and to be fair, I mean, there are again, there are continuum, as you say, mm-hmm. and a lot of us has narcissistic features and traits and borderline traits. So this stuff should be familiar territory, even in people that are in relationships that are stable. There still be though maybe those qualities lurking around and things.
Yes,
For some of you triggered something I was thinking about with Jodi Arias. Shoot, I can't think of what it was. Anyway, but this so men get involved with the testosterone gets them in
testosterone driven men.
Yeah,
they get
in trouble.
That's right.
And is that what that third chapter is?
Adrenaline driven men.
They tend to be, and they overlap those two groups. Is that what's in that third chapter? How to avoid all that?
Yes. Well, and then in the 13th chapter of the book, I have a section on actually how to find and rekindle a loving relationship. So it's kind of the antidote to what happens. But, you know, men along the way, I think there are basically four crisis points in a man's life. The first is when he's, you know, like between, you know, let's say 15 and 21 to 25, which I call the identity crisis. And then, of course,
that's Ericksonian stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's where, you know, especially young fellows these days are trying to figure out who they are as men and what they're going to do.
It's hard for them now. Especially
it's especially difficult. Yeah. Especially difficult.
Yeah.
And then the next crisis point, which is we can say the mother of all crises or the father of all crises, is the midlife crisis. That's around 40. That is customarily where men mostly find themselves getting into trouble.
And it's always seemed to me like something sets that up. Mm. In other words, a business unattended to in their 20s gets to them. That's when it falls apart.
I also think you're essentially at midlife, and if you're going to get in trouble, that's a good time to get in trouble because you have enough energy to get yourself out of trouble.
You have money. You have access. You have autonomy.
And you usually have years left. You know,
and you have time to get out.
The difficulty is in what I call the third crisis point, which is the existential crisis, which is around 60, 65, and that's when guys get themselves into trouble, but they usually don't have enough energy.
What
to get
kind of trouble?
Well, for instance, you know, how many CEOs and politicians have we seen carted off to prison at that point? A lot of it, you know, has to do, again, we talk about the narcissism and we talk about the arrogance where people are able to actually sustain doing something for years and get away with it until all of a sudden they can't.
And then, or is it that later on they start getting desperate or something's not gratifying enough or something? Or is it just
possibly,
both of those things?
Sure, possibly. Again, you know, it's as we're approaching the fourth crisis point, I call the completion crisis. That's at a time usually around 75 when a man is winding up his life. He's got to figure out, how many years do I have left? He turns and he looks back at his life and wonders, what have I accomplished? What's the legacy? You know, what's the mark I have made? That can be a time often where men, you know, get very, very depressed. We know the suicide rate increases after the age of 65, especially when men go through a divorce. There's also something going on. You probably are aware that the suicide rate is surging right now, especially
older
with baby
males.
Boomers. That's right.
Yeah.
And there's such a thing as gray divorce, where women who are still at a point when they feel like they either don't want the guy anymore, they can live without a man from this point forward, or they're young enough that they could get married again, but they certainly don't want to take care of this guy as he is aging and decompensating. Mm-hmm. So they're divorcing him. So you've got guys in their 60s or older that are coming out of marriages. They get depressed, and then the suicide rate really takes off.
Mm, it's awful.
10% higher than with women at that point.
I also imagine the loss of vitality and things like that contributes to it.
It's the aging issue. You know how many guys say, you know, oh, my God, you know, just yesterday I was feeling like a young man. Something can happen all of a sudden. It's almost not even chronological, you know, from one day to the next.
They step
down. Something happens and all of a sudden it's like now I'm an old man.
Yeah.
You know?
That's interesting. I don't think anybody talks about that. I kind of relate to that. I've noticed little step downs.
Yeah.
And I imagine they get worse as you get older.
Yeah.
And I deal a lot in my medical practice with couples, so I don't really see the single male who must feel that acutely.
Houston Smith, a great historian, one of his students said, well, Dr. Smith, now that you're an older man, what's old age like? And he said, well, he said, it's a lot like being young, only much worse.
Well, there's a famous I don't want to call it chapter. What do they call it? How's the Platonic dialogues broken down? But where he's interviewing an old man. I forget who it was. He's actually taken by his servants to his house.
Yeah.
And the old man is there interviewing Plato or Socrates. Mm. And he says, you know, how is it? He goes, well, you know, wish I had more vitality, but it's great not being bothered by the sexual drive. It's great not having that troubling me all the time.
I guess there's some innate wisdom to the fact that the testosterone begins to drop. But
we may undo that, by the way.
We are undoing it because we have now many people that are on testosterone replacement therapy, and so that can also get you
personally
in
looking forward to that, frankly, because I don't think we make enough of that. I think that's a missing ingredient for men and women.
Yeah.
And by the way, without that that testosterone, which is kind of a glue,
right,
people lose interest in each other.
I know.
I think it's important. Exactly.
That's right.
All right. So I want to go back to that third. I want to go back to, because mostly what I think who's downloading our podcast are, you know, people that are podcast users, and they're in their early part of their life. They're probably teens, 20s, and 30s, maybe some 40s. What do you say? Hey, Chris, what would you say? Chris. Hey, Gary. What's the average age of a download here, would you say, for this show?
You'd be surprised. It's probably in the mid to late 30s.
Okay, mid to late 30s. That's average. So there's a scatter around that. Mm-hmm. What do those guys need to watch out for? Now, they're probably married or getting towards marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And that third chapter again?
Right. Well, the fellas that are in their mid to late 30s are on target for the midlife. You know, even though we would have to say midlife customarily, you know, primarily now is closer to 50 because people are living longer. But it's still around 40, which is the time that fellas will get tripped up.
What happens?
What happens is that, let's say that they're married, okay? And then, you know, they're starting to have children. Men marry their girlfriends. Men want their girlfriends to remain being their girlfriends. So in other words, women take on men as projects, and they want to change them. Men marry a woman, and they don't want her to change. They like her just the way she is. Mm-hmm. But therein lies the rub. Women are going to change, and a lot of times men don't change as much as women want.
Explain that.
Well,
why do women change so much? In the mothering function, or their careers, or what?
It's that they get married, they become mothers, and that's the big surprise for fellas, is what happens when she turns her attention to mothering the children and away from him. At least it feels to him like he's losing his girlfriend.
Mm.
And that's when men become most vulnerable. They don't get enough attention at that point, and they're vulnerable to someone else that can be there to give him attention.
Now, women are vulnerable to the same thing, right?
More and more.
And particularly attention. Now, when you say attention for
appreciation, attention.
That's a word I don't think is tossed around. Men want to feel appreciated.
Everybody does.
I expect women want to be cherished. Men want to be appreciated. Yeah. Is that a...
Yes, I say women want to be cherished. Men want to be respected and honored.
Yeah.
But the truth is that both want to be appreciated.
Yeah, for what
and what happens
do. Yeah.
Is that when they get very, very busy raising families and working and trying to make ends meet, they tend to lack or not give as much appreciation to each other.
Well, and so I agree. And so men, that the deficiency is more in the sort of interpersonal sphere. Mm-hmm. Like they don't spend time talking and dialoguing and focusing.
Yeah.
And for men, on behalf of women, it's sexual, right?
Right.
They don't get enough sexual attention.
Yes, but you know what? It's really it's the kind of communication that comes when somebody you know, wants to get to know you and wants to be there for you, meets your needs, does the little things that indicate that you're important to me. Many, many men say, you know, yeah, I mean, I got involved in this affair, but the truth is that it really was that she was just so sweet.
Mm-hmm.
And I always say, you know, when I talk to men, I say, what's the one thing, desert island quality, that you want in a woman? And they'll tell me all sorts of things, you know, big boobs and this and that. And I go, okay, but really. And then when I say, how about sweetness?
Sweetness or kindness? I hear kindness a lot.
Is that the same word thing? I think so. But
yeah.
I use the word sweetness, and the guys erupt. Yeah. That's it. That's what I want.
Yeah.
I want the sweetness. I've had men that have said, they say to the wives, look, just treat me like you do the stranger, like you do the guy behind the meat counter. You know, just because why is it that I get the dregs of it? You know, you're so sweet and kind to everybody else, but not to me. And so I think the younger fellas, they start off, you know, with a certain naivete and belief.
You need a correlate program for women so they can learn what you've observed in men.
So many, you know, women, I think, have had a lot of support. When I started, Drew, and you probably know this, I've been a therapist for over 40 years. Most of my patients were women, and most of the therapists, 84% of therapists were women.
Mm.
You know, it's 94% today.
94% of women.
Were women. So the reason
why I say that again. 94% of therapists are women today?
Yes, yes.
I did not know
men
that.
Are not matriculate. Men are not going through college like they used to. They're certainly not going on to professional schools, medical school, mm-hmm. law school, et cetera.
Not the way
they're just
did.
Not doing it. Women are. Mm. After World War II, that's what men did. Women stayed home. Men went back to school, you know? It's the reverse now, because many men say, I don't have the money for it, I don't want the bills, you know, I want to get on with my life.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not doing that. So,
what about, I want to bring up something that was in the news recently, Pat Robertson. Did you see that thing he got bashed for? He said something, maybe you can, Gary, you can pull up the actual quote, and we can put it on the board here so Stephen can read it. Basically, he said he was talking to a man, or woman, I think,
mm-hmm.
and the husband was straying. And he basically said, "Well, if you treated him right, or if you were making the right kind of home and being the right kind of wife, he wouldn't stray." Really blaming the woman. It was really mm-hmm. clear. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know what he intended
right.
to say, but
yeah,
it
yeah.
came across
right,
as,
right.
"Hey, honey,
very
it's
harsh.
Your fault."
If very
you were,
harsh.
It came
yeah.
across as if you just have more sex, then yeah. he wouldn't look for sex elsewhere.
Right. That's a pretty right wing Christian thing. I think it's kind of fundamentalist. I think to point fingers in that direction. The truth is,
it's so much more complicated.
It's really complicated.
Yeah.
It's complicated for men and women. You know, the reason why, again, I started working a lot with men back in 87 was because they needed male figures in their lives. I started training interns to work with men, understand men. I also felt like it was arrogant of me to think that I was God's gift to women as a therapist until I understood more of what it meant to be a man myself.
Mm.
So I took the time to really start to work with men. I was trying to be as much a student as I was, a teacher of working with men, But men and women need the help, and they need the coaching in terms of how to take care of yourself, self-compassion, and how to be there for each other.
Well, it's I see it all, ultimately as trauma, attachment disorders.
Yeah, sure.
And deficiencies in closeness.
Everything's going back to trauma. I mean,
yeah.
In the early days when we were being trained and all, we weren't looking at it from that through that window.
Maybe there wasn't as much trauma. Now it's just everywhere.
Maybe. Well, that's
yeah.
true, isn't it, as
yeah.
well? I think there's a lot more trauma and drama
yeah.
in the world.
Yeah, it's yeah. really everything I see is on the addiction front.
Yeah,
the biology, it's genetics plus trauma.
Yeah,
come see me.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's where it goes.
That's right.
Do you have that quote from Pat Roberts? I really want to put that up there for Dr. Johnson. Here it comes. Okay. As for the man's culpability in being an adulterer, he says, well, he's a man. That's what Robertson says. Quote, like it or not, males have a tendency to wander a little bit, and what you want to do is make a home so wonderful that he doesn't want to wander.
Mm.
Thank
well,
you, Dr. Robertson. Thank yes, you, thank yeah, you, Pat yeah, Robertson. Yeah.
That's one of many that came out of the same this string
same
of quotes.
Diatribe.
Yeah,
well, that's
right.
that's the one I was talking about.
Yeah.
That's the one. Thank you for that, Gary.
Yeah.
And I was alarmed by that.
I understand.
I was alarmed. I understand what he means.
Sure. No, we can.
But I was alarmed by interpretation.
I know. But there is an interesting thing, and that is because I was talking to a couple of the fellas that were here in the studio before you arrived. We were talking about this, and there was back in yonder years. Men would go off to work, women would stay home, and the castle was the castle for the queen and the king. Men came home, and they still felt like they were kings in the castle.
Right.
These days, I hear many fellas say, "You know what? I'm not the king in the castle. I live in my wife's house.
Is it right?
She's the queen of the castle." And so they feel a bit disenfranchised. Now, part of the problem also is that, they go off. Maybe they've lost their job or they go off and they're working and now they have a woman boss. And so
it's on all fronts.
What's happening to them is they're feeling more emasculated. So men, are searching for, and that's why I say return to chivalry. Men are trying to find who they are as real men and their manhood and their masculinity. And a lot of times, they'll take the path of least resistance rather than the road less traveled.
Mm.
And that's how they get themselves in trouble. It seemed like a good idea at the time. And they had a notion that they were going to do something. It was going to be helpful, and it turned out not to be the case.
Talk about cheating?
Yeah, well, yes. That.
Well, it's a way of asserting themselves and as
that's
somebody
right.
who's not emasculating.
That's right.
Yes.
Exactly. That's right. Yet. That's right. It starts. I always say it's great until it's not great. And it can be not great. It can turn on a dime.
And a woman who's going to engage in that is, I would imagine, I don't have any data off the top of my head, but I imagine she would be more up the borderline spectrum.
Yes.
Or at least have those liabilities.
Yeah, right. But coming back again to, what Pat is saying or suggesting, is that it's true, it's equally true for men and for women. I say you've got to maintain courting behavior through your marriage.
Yeah,
you've got
I
to continue. If you want to have a good marriage, first of all, you've got to be good friends. Mm-hmm. Your friendship is going to be key to the longevity and sustainability of your relationship. Mm-hmm. If you're not good friends, or I say I got you back. You know, it should be I've got your back. Not this
back.
Kind of bickering and arguing and fighting.
That's something powerful. That so it's I got your back. It's I got your back.
Yeah, got you back. It should be I've got your back. And that's always what you say, baby. You've got my back. I know you're there for me. Mm-hmm. So when the fella comes home, this is not Ozzie and Harriet. She's not waiting there with a martini, in high heels. But it's like, honey, I'm glad to see you. It's the kind of endearing, ways that we treat each other. Love is a verb, right? It's an action. It's the way that we act with each other lovingly that makes the difference. My wife and I have been together 37 years. We've been through a lot. We have three kids, 28, 29, and 33. Mm. We've been through a lot of challenges, and there are times when it's been very, very difficult. But what's happened over the years is that our love has deepened. Mm-hmm. And when I wrote this article on rekindling your love, falling back in love again, I wrote that article, and I held the article until I knew it was true. Mm-hmm. Theoretically, I thought, I think this is true. But I had to experience it myself. Mm-hmm. And,
it's repairing and again, we come with these, we each of us come with our intimacy deficiencies.
Yeah.
And through hanging in, experiencing, mm-hmm. and deepening the connection,
right.
You should have a deeper love. You should be more intimately connected.
Yeah.
Should be what happened.
Well,
repairing the injuries of childhood and stuff, too, the way.
Absolutely. I've worked with older couples in this past year. I've had four couples where people I've worked with where their parents have died within just a few months of each other. The long relationship, 60 years, and when the woman goes first, mm-hmm. and the guy, is usually, I'm out of here.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like they have bonded, they've been together, and where there's really true love, rather than, they've made time for each other, rather than doing time, mm-hmm. For all those years with each other, then what happens is that, it's the bond, they lose it, and then they go on, so... Anyway, I'm trying to say to you that if people can actually maintain that bond of love, it will grow. If they can get over and get past those speed bumps, those hardships, and not just succumb to divorce.
The whole idea of commitment is something that's completely lost, crazily enough. And we don't hang in with things. Just everything's disposable.
Right.
Well, I got to take a break in a couple of minutes here. I'm going to take calls after that break. But I want to wrap up with what, or at least this segment, what mm-hmm. the nature, what is the spiritual warrior? That seems like that's a sort of a common, even like Jung had that sort of image as one of his paradigms, didn't mm-hmm. he?
And it's an archetype.
Yeah, it's an archetype. But it seems like it's been coming up a lot these days. I feel like it's something that's in the ethos.
I do too.
That men respond to it in some way. What is it and why do men respond to it?
It's innate. Well, it's when I was 38, I started hearing the words, the sacred path, the way of the spiritual warrior. And so as I meditated on that and asked, what does that mean? What I heard was, bring good men together and bring out the best in them. And then what I heard was, and then they'll want to give back. Spiritual warriors in the world are, I think it is where men are most connected, or people, let's say men and women, are most connected to their joy. Their joy comes from being of service.
Is being a spiritual warrior today dangerous in any way? Because people are so... they're so skeptical of everything that they almost like don't want to hear the message or want to destroy the messenger when it's reminds them of the pain they're in.
Shoot the messenger, right.
It really has to be a warrior today.
Yeah, I know. I think that there's an element of risk to everything, and so you have to essentially evaluate the risk that you're going to take. But I think if you do it mindfully, and mindfulness is being present, fully present and aware in the moment, and is a relaxed state as possible, exercising judgment as in discernment rather than judgment as in condemnation. And so mindfulness and awareness and thinking and discernment in terms of the actions that one takes, I think really helps to guide a person through.
I'm doing a whole podcast on mindfulness. Dan Siegel, Dan?
Sure I do.
He's coming in. We'll talk about that, no doubt. I'm mm-hmm. big in that field. So, but Dr. Johnson, thank you so much. We have to say goodbye and end this podcast. The Sacred Path, The Way of the Spiritual Warrior is the book. You need to click through It's on our – Chris, it'll be on the website at doctor.com.
Absolutely.
You can just click right through there, or you can click through on the Amazon banner. A reminder, Chris, people are liking the Swinging Sounds of the Drew podcast. I saw some tweets about it. We're going to give them another version, yes? You're going to give them some choices?
And thanks for all the great reviews on iTunes as well.
Really? They've been good? Thank you. Well done, Chris. Well done. A reminder that Dr. Johnson is the founder and director, co-founder and director of the Los Angeles Men's Leadership Guild. The website is drdrstephen.com. Are there ways people can reach you other than through the website?
It's also the Men's Center Los Angeles, menscenterlosangeles.com, and they can call if they want, 818-348-8948.
I suspect, Gary, we'll have Dr. Johnson back, in the future as we see how our audience responds to this, their interest is, and maybe we can focus in on one particular area as we go along.
Perfect.
Here.
Thanks so much.
I think it'd be interesting to have him in with Corolla, too. So maybe we'll have him on the Drew and Adam podcast.
That'd be fun.
There'll be a whole bunch of different kinds of questions from him.
Cool. Yeah.
And I'll try to support you through that.
Thank you.
We'll be back
appreciate
after this.
That.
Thanks so much.
Okay. Pleasure.
How about our friends at GoToMeeting, everybody? You know that Adam and I use GoToMeeting all the time. It's hardly a week goes by that we're not having meetings with GoToMeeting because you can meet with people from anywhere. All you need to launch a meeting is an iPad or a computer. You can even join the meeting from your iPhone. Get everybody together. It's like being there. GoToMeeting with HD faces. And the part of it that I like the most is not only are you actually present in a video conference in real time, but you can actually throw your document up on the screen. The other members of the team can put directly onto the document. It's unbelievable. And then they can throw their document up and you can adjust their documents all while you're working together as a team. It's no fooling. It's something that we use on a regular basis. So you need to go to meeting. You can get it for free for 30 days at gotomeeting.com. Click on the try it free button and then use the promo code Drew. Be sure to use that promo code Drew. Go to GoToMeeting and launch a meeting today with your team. GoToMeeting. Meeting is believing. Welcome back to the program. Reminder, you can get these groovy tunes at the Swingin' Sounds of the Dr. Drew podcast on iTunes and at drdrew.com. And also support the Adam and Drew show. I imagine most people listening to this show are also Adam and Drew fans, but supporting that show, you go to the adamanddrdrewshow.com website and you click through there. But to keep this all afloat for us, so Corolla lets me keep doing these things. Got lots of interesting ideas to keep you all interested. I've got some very interesting guests coming up. And right now we're just going to phones. Let's head on out to Mary, who's in Maryland. Mary, what's going on?
Hi. I've been having, anxiety and panic attacks for about 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if it started from an incident where I smoked pot and I hallucinated.
Mm. Did you have panic at that episode?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, pot has been documented to induce panic. Now, the presumption has always been is that this is a person probably who was going to get panic anyway, and it just sort of was precipitated by the cannabis. There's no causational link, at least in what I've read. But I treated a guy who was actually a very successful guy who smoked pot only three times and on the third time had this terrible panic and from then on was disabled by panic. I mean, just like severe panic and multiple medication and treatments and things. And I sort of referred him out to other people. I don't know what happened to him. But he was convinced that the cannabis was the problem. He had this sense that it wouldn't have happened had he not smoked pot. I'm not convinced of that, but I am convinced that it can sort of open up that circuitry that we call panic. And I've seen it a number of times that people suddenly develop panic that persists long after the exposure to the cannabis. And that sounds like you. How have you been treated?
See, I go to a psychologist,
mm-hmm.
and I talk, and I just – there's nothing that – I can say that make them think that, I don't have the past in it. And when I go to psychiatrists, they just, I don't know, they put me on antidepressants. So
has anything worked?
No, except clonazepam.
So you still get panic?
I do. Yes. Yes, definitely.
And how much clonazepam are you on?
0.5 milligrams as needed.
How often are you taking it?
Sometimes every day.
It's a pretty small amount, and even if you're taking it every day, as long as you don't get momentum with it, it's not a big deal. You know,
yeah.
It's not a medicine you want to be on all the time because it can make you drowsy and maybe blunt some of your thinking a little bit. But if that solves the problem, the thing with panic that I had a panic disorder when I was younger. I had terrible panic attacks when I was in my late teens and early 20s. And it seemed to me, and I've sort of understood this to be the case, that you can kind of learn your way out of it, let's say, that you can sort of learn to tolerate it. So you can not be so panicked by the panic, if that makes sense?
Definitely. Yeah, that's what I'm, like, trying to do, right? Like, I'm trying to work my way through.
Yeah, it's the problem is you've been suffering for 7 years, so it's pretty, like, very much, you know, a part of you, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But you're doing the right stuff, which is, you know, use pharmacology where you can and sparingly, and then do talk therapy and, you know, learn how to manage the panic when it comes. It's so unpleasant. Ugh, awful.
So being on, because my one psychiatrist, like, wanted me off clonazepam, he was like, no, I don't want you on that at all.
Well, I understand why he wouldn't, because you might, that's kind of on and off the clonazepam, maybe kind of perpetuating things a little bit, because then you get withdrawal of the clonazepam, and that intensifies the panic. Does he want you on an SSRI?
He put me on Prestige.
Which is as a dual agent. So, is it working?
I hate it.
Why?
I get anxiety when I take it. My heart beats really fast, yeah. And I get like palpitations.
Yeah, you got to make sure it's somebody. It's so hard. Listen. Unfortunately, there's no sort of test you can take that tells the doctor exactly what you should be taking. But you got to go back and make sure you find something that works for you and a doctor you can really work with on this, because the thing is, Mary, you should be able to find a solution to this, and you're only 23, and so you're in that age group when panic, by the way, is most intense, and it gets better later, like as you hit your early 30s and things. It'll just – you naturally kind of grow out of it a little bit too. So
okay.
Kind of keep working on it, all right?
All right.
All right, Mary, good luck.
All right, thank you.
Bye. This is Sarah. Sarah, what's up?
Hey.
Well,
I have a question about a gentleman – that I was in a long-term relationship with. He had smoked crack cocaine for about 20 years.
Wow.
And, yeah. I mean, according to him, it was, you know, quote-unquote social experience. And he had supposedly quit, and then we broke up. And then he reached back out to me because he had lost his job in February. And the reason that he lost his job was because he had tested positive.
Mm-hmm.
But he's telling me today, now, that he's away from it, not going to ever do it again. And I'm just curious. I mean, somebody that's had a problem like that for such a long time, is it something that they can just stop on their own?
No way. He may feel like he can, but he won't be able to. And just look what's happened. He told you he was going to stop, and now he's lost his job. And the consequences will increase. So he, at minimum, has got to get involved with some kind of 12-step program, at minimum. So to send him over to CA and get with his peers and start sort of opening his mind to solutions.
But he blames it on me, the reason why he is doing it. And I don't want it in my life. I mean, I kind of feel like I'm being codependent if I help him.
Well, there's help and there's help. Yes, if you give him so much help that it allows him to keep using, yeah, you're being codependent. But if you're just being a supportive presence and urging him to go take care of himself, that's not codependent. It's pretty hard, though, not to be codependent if you yourself, again, having been involved with this guy for as long as you probably were, if you yourself aren't doing some work on your own. You got to have somebody there supporting you, or he'll kind of suck you in. You're already spinning just from the bullshit he's feeding you.
Exactly. So do I need like Alan? Is it Al-Anon?
Yes,
or?
Al-Anon will be fantastic for you. It will be. You really will enjoy it. I guarantee you. You're ripe for an Al-Anon. Go tell your story, get a sponsor, and have her help you with dealing with him. Okay.
Yeah, I could do that through church.
Yeah, It'll be great. You'll be. Call me back. Let me know how it goes. You'll be stunned. Okay.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Sure. You bet. Good luck. Thanks. Okay. This is John. John, what's up?
Oh my goodness, Dr. Drew. God, it worked. Hold on. Sorry.
Uh-oh. Yes.
Dr. Drew.
Yeah.
Hello. It is amazing to talk to you. You are, I listen to you every day. Okay. Dig.
Dig.
I am currently withdrawing from diazepam. I was on it for 2 years, along with Suboxone.
Oh,
and I've been able to, essentially my doctor closes, he closed his practice, and I didn't get like a recommendation to another place or anything, so I didn't really want to be on all the stuff anyway. So it's been good to like try to get off it anyway, but fortunately I'm having like major symptoms right now with the diazepam withdrawal, and I stopped taking it about 5 or 6 days ago.
Yeah.
And
right, so how much were you on?
What's that?
How much were you on?
Oh, 10 milligrams a day. But I would take it at night because I'm like insomniac and I can't sleep.
Well, the other name for diazepam is Valium. And Valium withdrawal is quite intense. By the way, you're never supposed to take a benzo with Suboxone. Interesting that you were prescribed those combos. Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah, it tells you a lot about the doctors these days.
Just saying. So you have, you know, you're at high risk for seizure. It's extremely unpleasant. It takes about 2 weeks. You're right now, the next day or two is sort of the peak.
I'm at work at typing on the computer.
Yeah, you climb the wall, shaking, irritable, agitated.
Yeah,
extremely anxious, no sleep, but then seizure, really high risk for seizure. It will die down over about the next 4 days, and then it will come back again, and you'll actually find the second peak to be even more unpleasant because it's such a disappointment that it comes back, but it will die out pretty fast. The seizure risk again goes up during that second phase at about 10 days out.
I read about that, and I have a lot of the other symptoms.
Listen,
but
something as simple as Neurontin can really do a lot to ameliorate these symptoms. Can you talk to another doctor?
Obamacare lasts till 26. I turned 26 in February, so I just like got my health insurance revoked. So it'd be kind of difficult, like financial wise. But I could.
You can go to a county hospital essentially for free. So go to a county facility. Do whatever you got to do to get some coverage because this is kind of dangerous to do this on your own. 10 milligrams is not a lot to come off of. It's a modest amount. And the Suboxone may cover you a little bit, though I got to say I don't know much about Suboxone. When I take people off drugs, I take them off everything. So I don't know how.
I mean, I've heard you talk about everything about the Suboxone over the past few months because I knew I was going to have to stop.
Well, did you stop the Suboxone too? Did you stop Suboxone too?
I actually had to go buy some on the street.
If you were to stop that, that would be hell. You can't do both. I know,
and this whole time I thought it was the Suboxone, and then I was like, wait, I stopped the Valium too. So I went and looked on the computer today. I mean, the list of symptoms is ridiculous. There's 30, 40 symptoms, suicidal, depressed,
it's very uncomfortable.
Shaking, can't eat, can't sleep.
Right.
And I woke up at 2 this morning, and I couldn't even go back to sleep.
Yeah, it's very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I'm shocked that you slept at all.
Yeah.
Well, listen. You go.
It's a mess.
Yeah, you got to stay on the Suboxone, and you should find a doctor that can give you something to cover that benzo withdrawal. And good that you're getting off stuff. That's the good news. You're getting off things. The bad news is you're doing it kind of a dangerous way. I'm sorry. What you might do is maybe go to an NA meeting and see if anybody knows anybody there, because you know the 12-step meetings are good resources for doctors and healthcare systems that really can help in situations like this. And as you know, people that are into drugs aren't into insurance, aren't into saving money. And so many people in those meetings have been in your situation where they don't have health care and yet have been able to find people that can help, because there's lots of ways to go about it. It's just tricky and you have to understand where to go and somebody has to tell you and it's cumbersome. Good luck, John. I'll take one more call here from Robert. What's up, Robert?
Hi, Dr. Drew. How are you?
Good. What's going on?
I just was wondering when at what stage of dealing with a drug addict do you say, okay, that's it, I'm walking away, and start implementing the separation, I guess, from the person?
That's a very personal decision. Some people never do, even when they know that other person is dying. Some people do early. Tell me what's going on with you specifically.
Well, it's someone that's like a brother to me who I have just seen deteriorate over the past year, stemming from a bad breakup. I had first told this person when they broke up with the female to, you know, come into my home with me and, you know, let's do this differently than you would have handled it before. And he was sober for a while, and then seeing a therapist for several sessions, but it wasn't providing the instant gratification. So it started with some steroid use, which then skyrocketed into the MDMA and cocaine occasionally. And now it's like every weekend type of thing. We're going on 4 or 5 day binges. And when that happens, you know, there's, you know, abusive behavior towards myself, his parents.
What's he binging on?
His parents have called me, texted me numerous times asking me what's going on. I mean, now that the whole story has been told,
what's he binging
and
on?
It's still not changing.
What's he binging on?
I don't know what they want from me.
Robert.
Yes.
What's he binging on?
MDMA.
Oh, no. Oh, his phone cut out. All right, so let me try to answer the question without having the information I need. Just to say that the best thing to do always is to go to Al-Anon or have a therapist yourself first, because you will tend to leave out of anger. And when you do leave an addict, it's actually important that you leave with love, believe it or not, that you leave in a supportive way, that you let them know very clearly that it's because you care about them that you can't stick around, but that you are there. So the way I say it is, I support the recovery, reject the disease. And it's a very hard message to give somebody. It's a very hard message for them to receive in a healthy way. So it's something that you can't usually do alone. You've got to sort of plan with either a therapist or an Al-Anon. Detach with love is what you'd learn with Al-Anon. And that doesn't mean abandon them, and it certainly doesn't mean cutting them off. And it doesn't mean – I think the term tough love has been grotesquely distorted and overused in recent years. It means caring about them enough to deliver a message by no longer participating in their life. It's something that Robert's back. Let me talk to him. So, Robert, I was going on about what you should do. Unfortunately, you have to listen to the podcast to hear it. But you need your own therapist or an Al-Anon group.
Oh, I've made some miraculous changes for the positive for myself.
Good.
Within the last year. And that's been one of the things that I've done. Unfortunately, you know, still seeing people that are crossing paths in the same circles, you know, the person, whenever they're brought up, I actually haven't had any communication with them, but there's still that anger when I'm, you know, God, he's still doing Molly and, you know, still on the steroids and acting like an idiot in front of people that are still bringing it to my attention. You know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah, I get it. And usually that combo, steroids and MDMA, that just smacks of sex addiction for me too. So,
oh, definitely.
Yeah,
definitely.
So that's probably going on as well. And that's stuff that takes a lot of work. He's got to want to get better. He's got to hit bottom with it. I mean, just keep encouraging him to take care of himself and let him know that, you know, you're leaving because you care enough to deliver that message, and you can't stand staying around while he destroys himself. It's not something you can sit and watch and be a part of.
Absolutely.
So, but Rob, yeah, you having your own sort of cord there to support, like a core, you know, a lifeline, is what's important in helping them. Talk to Sarah. Sarah, what's up?
Hello.
Hi, Sarah. What's going on?
Hi.
Hey.
I had a question about borderline personality disorder.
Okay.
I don't really know if some things would be considered borderline, and I'm just trying to figure out how to look for a therapist going into that.
So you're worried that you have borderline?
I am.
You are.
And I realize, like, it comes on much earlier.
Than what?
You know, like, it's what you said, like, teens and your early 20s.
Right.
And it's something I know that I have mood issues. I've been struggling with it all my life, mm-hmm. but I've never, you know, I've always been very private about it. And, you know, you get to the point, I'm just fed up and I don't know what to do.
So you've never had treatment?
Never.
Okay. So, well, listen, first you need a diagnosis. You're assuming you have borderline personality disorder. You may have just borderline traits. You may have a mood disorder. I mean, it could be a lot of different things. So go to a good, you know, board-certified psychiatrist, and anyone who's board-certified will be perfectly capable of diagnosing you. And then the key with people with what are called character pathologies is that you have sort of a multidisciplinary kind of approach. Borderline, there's something called dialectical behavioral therapy that's thought to be very helpful with them. Medication can be very important for borderlines as well in terms of stabilizing the mood. And then, you know, staying in a very close relationship with a therapist over a long period of time. Most therapists will only take on a few borderlines because it's a chaotic ride. But if you get someone who really will work with you, it can go a long way to helping things. And just talking to you, you know, borderlines give me a certain feel when I'm around them, and I can tell when somebody's severe borderline and when they're not. I don't think you have severe issues. I really don't. I think it's something that would be, you know, you should definitely avail yourself of treatment, okay?
That's something I struggle with, too, because I feel like I have, you know, like two different personalities. I have one that's very rational.
Well, that's that kind of borderline stuff, when you sink into the chaos. And and it's okay. That's will sort of glue together. That people okay. people think about medication being the glue and therapy being the glue as well. Sarah, thanks so much. I've got to run now. I want to thank Dr. Stephen Johnson for coming on the program today. I want to thank all of you for joining me as well. Please remember to click through at drdrew.com on the Amazon link, and do not forget to support the sponsors of this program and the Corolla Network. And finally, you can support the pirate ship by buying, say, the Swing and Sounds of the Dr. Drew podcast, which you're hearing now. We also have Brandon Stockdale's book up, The Boy with the Gun. It's available on Amazon. Click through at drdrew.com. I really think this is time well spent if you read that book. It's a very interesting story about a young man who is deeply in trouble with oppositional defiant disorder and a criminal history, who helped himself out and now is a therapist that helps other people. Thank you all for listening. Again, thanks again, Dr. Stephen Johnson. Thanks for those of you calling. And, of course, thank you for listening. See you next time.
Corolla Digital.